Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Bon dia, hafa a day, noia e Māori and good fella morning. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois, and this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, an unexplained wave of fish deaths has spread along Papua New Guinea's New Ireland coast.
The stench of all the dead fish was in our face. And within 2 hours of being there, I literally couldn't breathe.
Also, Bougainville's president says his side won't accept anything less than independence.
For us to pursue independence, the peace agreement reminds us that it will be based only on the outcome of the vote of the people, which is independence.
And it looks like it's the end of the road for Moana Pacifica, or is it?
It's a really sad day for Moana Pacifica, but it's also a really important day moving forward because now we have a voice at the table to shape what 2028 and beyond looks like.
So stay tuned for those stories and more. Our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Vinaka, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, an unexplained wave of fish deaths has spread along Papua New Guinea's New Ireland coast for 6 months and is now on the doorstep of the provincial capital, Kavieng. Tens of thousands of fish have washed ashore with no confirmed cause and no sign of when it might end. Now, buyers are avoiding fish at the capital's main market and fishing communities are worried about how they'll feed their families. Natasha Emick reports.
When Rebecca Marigou heard about thousands of fish washing up dead on the small island of Nusa Laman, she wanted to see it for herself.
The stench of all the dead fish was in our face. And, you know, within 2 hours of being there, I literally couldn't breathe.
She's a journalist working alongside NGO Island Awareness, and her team have been following the ongoing fish kills in New Ireland. Just a short boat ride from Kavieng, the island of Nusa Laman has been hit hard.
At Nusa Laman, we approached by boat, seeing everything that was floating in the water and coming onto the reefs and seeing it firsthand before going to the beach to observe, it hit us differently.
The local marine conservation team has been following the spread of the ongoing fish kills since the first wave hit in Kafka Village in December last year, 6 months on, and the deaths have spread to several more communities along New Ireland's northern coast.
It seems to be happening in waves. So it comes and it affects one community and then it goes. It slows down in the community and then it goes to the next community.
Their records show more than 34,000 dead fish and marine life have already washed ashore, and now the problem is well and truly on Kavieng's doorstep.
Nusa Laman, I think it had a bigger impact because they are so close to the market and they're so close to Kavieng town where everybody gets their supply of fish.
She says buyers at the markets are already changing their behaviours, and as more people report symptoms like nausea, breathing difficulties and skin irritation, fears are growing, especially for more vulnerable members of the community, including the elderly.
There are a good percentage of people that are hesitating to go to the markets. What's happening now is every time people want to buy fish, they have to ask where it's coming from and to avoid as much as possible buying fish from the highway. And the islands towards Tigak and Nuenova are the ones that supply the fish. So it's raised an alarm now because Nusa Laman is one of those islands.
Rebecca spoke with many families on Nusa Laman who rely on selling fish in Kavieng to get by.
The person that I was talking to supplies Kavieng Hotel with traveling, and that is his main source of income. So you could imagine the impact it has had on their everyday lives and their means of survival. And we talked to two mothers, and one of them couldn't hold back her tears, you know?
One of them is Brenda Renson. She's a female leader on the island.
We're thinking now, if we take the fish, will people even be happy to buy it? Because many boats have already seen all the dead fish in the sea and told people in town. I'm worried about our future. Will we be all right? Will the fish keep dying? Or when will it stop? For us on this island, the sea is our garden. The only way we get money and buy food is from the sea.
Another mother, Gertrude Lapun, said she is worried there's no end in sight.
I sit and think and ask my husband, hey, this thing happening to us is like nothing we've ever seen. And he would assure me that it will end. But I would say, I don't think it would end. We see they are still dying.
PNG's Conservation and Environment Protection Authority, or CEPA, carried out rapid field surveys in the affected areas earlier this year, but their first investigation was unable to pinpoint the cause of the contamination. Instead, the survey found unusual water conditions, traces of heavy metal, and signs of algal blooms, with further testing needed. Water resource scientist Brian Furman from the non-profit group Clean Water Help has been volunteering his assistance. After examining the samples sent by CEPA, he says the strongest explanation appears to be the harmful algal blooms.
There were a couple reports. One of the report was consistent with what we would have thought, where there was some fluctuating pHs, there were some high nutrients in some places, and that would all kind of like point towards nutrients that are causing harmful algal blooms.
He says other theories, including mining contamination and underwater volcanic activity, are considered less likely because of the distances involved. Islanders are now being encouraged to document any unusual or new algae they notice during fish kill events by taking photos or collecting samples.
You know, just a picture of the algae, we wouldn't be able to confirm, like, for sure that's the thing that makes the toxins, but we could say, okay, that matches what the physical characteristics of a type of toxic algae, and then that would give us more evidence to say, okay, it's worth doing a more thorough scientific looking at DNA or doing toxin analysis.
And that's Brian Furman from Clean Water Help, ending that report from Natasha Emick. And just to note, Pacific Beat have contacted PNG's New Ireland Governor, Byron Chan, for an update on whether further testing is going to determine the cause of the fish kills will be done. We also asked him whether any support will be provided to affected communities as the crisis continues to spread, but he has not responded yet. Now, the Australian government has refused to release internal documents about Tuvalu's trust fund after an investigation by French international news agency AFP found that funds have been invested into fossil fuels. Valued at around US $200 million, Tuvalu relies on the wealth fund to support its national budget and long-term financial stability as the country faces mounting climate costs. Australia is the largest contributor to the fund and is also on its board of directors. AFP reports that Australia's Foreign Affairs Department told them it can't release the documents because they could cause diplomatic damage. Reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with Research Associate Dr. Wesley Morgan at the UNSW Institute for Climate Risk and Response, who says the investments are completely at odds with the climate threat Tuvalu is facing.
So I think Australia is trying to avoid diplomatic embarrassment. So right now, Australia is working with Tuvalu and other Pacific Island countries ahead of the COP31 UN climate talks. And Australia is helping to organise pre-COP meetings that will be held in Fiji and in Tuvalu, and is working with Tuvalu to invite world leaders to come to Tuvalu in October as part of those pre-COP meetings to see for themselves the reality of climate impacts in the Pacific. For decades, Tuvalu has been the poster of the impacts of climate change. You know, the narrative is save Tuvalu and you save the world. So, you know, how would it look if Australia is on the board of the Tuvalu Trust Fund and that fund is investing in fossil fuels? It's just totally incongruous, right? That the Tuvalu Trust Fund, which counts Australia as a board member, would be investing in the means of Tuvalu's destruction.
And what does this reveal sort of overall about the way that finances of climate vulnerable countries like Tuvalu are actually managed?
The Tuvalu Trust Fund seems to me to be a fairly innovative source of finance for Tuvalu. So, you know, as a small island nation, an atoll nation, there are limited options for development. You know, you're not going to attract large amounts of capital to come to your country to develop new industries. And so there's limited options for generating revenue. You know, Tuvalu has relied to some extent on fishery revenue. For a little while, there was some income from a .tv internet domain name. But, you know, there are really limited options. So having a trust fund, which was set up in the late 1980s with development partners, including Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom was previously part of the trust fund. Having a trust fund that invests abroad in order to generate revenue for Tuvalu is a good idea, I think, and something that enables development in Tuvalu over time. And it's been recognised as previously a good source of climate finance for helping Tuvalu cope with these impacts of climate change.
What overall responsibility? We know that Australia is on the board of the trust. What responsibility does Australia have for how the Tuvalu Trust Fund is invested?
So Australia and New Zealand are on the board for the trust. And the trust was established through an international treaty. So my understanding is that decisions about investment through the trust are made amongst the countries that are part of that treaty. So the Tuvalu Prime Minister has said that he's very disappointed to learn that the Tuvalu Trust Fund is exposed to investments in fossil fuels. You know, this is not surprising that he would be concerned, given Tuvalu is leading global efforts to transition away from fossil fuels. As I say, the issue is not so much the fund itself. The fund is an innovative source of finance for Tuvalu, but that finance should not be going to invest in climate pollution, which is, ultimately an existential threat for Tuvalu.
And that's Research Associate Dr. Wesley Morgan speaking to Jordan Fennell there. And Pacific Beat has reached out to the Australian government for comment, but has not received a response. Alrighty, meteorological agencies around the world are warning that a major El Nino is occurring and could bring less rainfall and possible droughts to the Pacific Islands. The US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared El Nino on June the 11th and states a prolonged period of above average temperatures in the equatorial Pacific is expected to peak. It's prompted concern in the Pacific. So on the line to discuss this weather system and what it could bring is Laitia Fifita, Director of the Tonga Meteorological Services. With that, I say malo tau mai pongpongini, Laitia.
Good morning, malo tau te mai pongpongini. Greetings from the Tonga Meteorological Service.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. For those who really don't understand, what is El Nino and why is this particular El Nino system causing such a concern?
Thank you very much, Maggie. First of all, just to give a quick background information about the question you have given. Basically, El Nino is a natural climate pattern or phenomena that occurs basically when majority of the tropical Pacific Ocean becomes warmer than average. Eh? It becomes warmer sea surface temperature. It's really a recurring that usually takes place every 2 to 7 years. In its definition and in its characteristics, El Nino is one of the many phases of the El Nino Southern Oscillation. It's really important that our listeners and the people tuning into the call of APC this morning has a clear scientific background information about El Nino Southern Oscillation. It comes in three varieties or three different phases. Its neutral phase, the El Nino phase, La Nina phase. And currently in the Pacific and globally, worldwide, we are in the El Nino phase. So this basically means that the trade winds become weaker, warmer water spreads towards the east, heading for South America across our tropical Pacific Ocean, which also alters rainfall patterns when the climate system shifts away from the Western Pacific towards our Central Pacific, where the Pacific Islands are across the entire ocean. I think this is it's also important to note that this is a coupling effect. It's the interaction of the ocean, the sea surface temperature becoming warmer than average, and its coupling effect and interaction to the atmosphere. It is a concerning not only to Tonga, the Pacific, but worldwide, because the climate and weather patterns will respond and will shift in the coming next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, and so do you think, Leitia, then, that we're more likely to see cyclones this summer because of the El Nino?
Yes, from the perspective of Tonga, the likelihood of tropical cyclone season this summer is one of the possible impacts. On a climatological average and perspective, when we are in El Nino phase, for Tonga's context, and it's also relevant to other Pacific Island countries, when we are in the El Nino phase, coming this tropical cyclone season in November to April next year for Tonga, our likelihood or the frequency of tropical cyclone will be elevated. There's an increased risk of tropical cyclone activity coming this summer, this tropical cyclone for Tonga. But not only that, in cyclones, there are other impacts as well, right? I think for Tonga, we are forecasting below average rainfall for all island divisions in the next 6 months. The likelihood of drought has been elevated as well. But not only that, the likelihood of marine heat waves and possible risk of coral bleaching is also elevated in the next 3 to 6 months for Tonga. So it's not only the cyclones that we are looking in terms of potential impacts, but we're looking at rainfall deficiencies, also drought, and the increased likelihood of marine heat waves and coral bleaching.
So because of all those types of emergency situations, you know, for Pacific countries like Tonga, what then is your agency recommending in response to El Nino? Like, do you have action plans in place already?
Yes, just for the information and for the record, firstly, Tonga has declared El Nino. An El Nino declaration was declared on the 19th of June, about a week ago. And not only that, but our government, our prime ministers, a cabinet briefing was delivered and a cabinet decision was approved, noting this declaration of El Nino. And then the response preparedness plan trickles down from the top-down approach and reverse. So very recently, the National Disaster Risk Management Committee has been called. We had a meeting this week on Monday, bringing in cluster leads to prepare ourselves for these potential impacts that are already here, and potentially to amplify in the next 6 months. In terms of our preparations in relation to the current drought warning alerts that we are putting out, please do take note that a drought warning has been enforced for the Hapai group of islands, and a drought alert has been enforced for Niuafoʻou, Niutaputapu, Vavaʻu, and also Ewa Island divisions. Yeah? So these drought level of warnings basically follows our standard operating procedures in terms of the rainfall deficiencies that are currently in place. Yeah? So these warning levels for drought will be likely to be elevated in the next month or so to declaring drought for our island divisions, given the forecast for below average rainfall for the next 3 to 6 months. And in terms of the agencies, civil societies, NGOs, and basically the community, awareness programs has been delivered through radio, TV, interviews like this, but also on social media. I think it's the sense of urgency for being preparedness. It's really important.
Mm.
And our agencies, government-led agencies, task. There will be another National Disasters Management Committee meeting being called next week, Tuesday, and basically on a weekly basis to foresee and to better prepare, to deploy resources, mobilization of staff and human resources, also any other urgent needs.
Like, dear, when you talk about, you know, droughts happening, how much then would this impact really, and we know Tonga relies heavily on its fishery sector, yeah, how much do you think it'll impact that sector?
Yes, I think the impacts on the fisheries sector, first of all, when we talk about fisheries, we need to be very clear. There is different categorization in terms of deep sea, long line fishing, the reef fishing. So, but in terms of a long line fisheries, this movement of the warmer and cooler sea surface temperatures also affects the migration of fish like tuna, wahoo, and all those deep sea fishes. They migrate further away from our waters during El Nino phase. So one of its possible implications is that the long-line fishing sector, the catch, the harvest is expected to decrease. Yeah? But coming in onshore near the reefs and then inland, our fish, in relation to this marine heat wave that's evident in our Pacific waters at the moment, and also trickling down to Tongan waters. The possibility of a fish dying is a likelihood because of these extreme heat conditions, but also affects corals. Coral bleaching as well is the home for fish and then spawning responses. So I think the fisheries sector could be affected. But not only that, from the perspective of Tonga, it's not only the fisheries sector, the agriculture sector, and in terms of our food security and supplies, will be affected as well. Kava, taro, yams, plants that are not resilient to prolonged drought and heat conditions, they will be affected as well. It will be a matter of time because some of these impacts will reveal itself in 3 to 6 months' time because this climate phenomena of El Nino is a slow onset type of natural hazard. And the impacts are felt further out 3 to 6 months' time.
Yeah, Laitia, thank you so much for updating us and letting us know a great insight into what El Nino is and what it's currently doing to the Pacific region, especially there in Tonga. I just want to say malo apito for joining us here on Pacific Beat. And that there was Laitia Fifita, Director of the Tonga Meteorological Services.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
There's no limit on what you can achieve. And I think having that mentality and that support from my family has been what's really driven me to continue pushing in this field. And hopefully we'll make a breakthrough to improve outcomes for mums and babies.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, the recent eruption of the Mount Bagana volcano in Bougainville highlights the need for reliable telecommunications in the area and better evacuation planning, according to a local official. Last week, Stage 1 alert was issued for nearby communities to be vigilant after the volcano's most significant activity in 2 years sent glowing lava fragments down its northwest slope and a low grey ash plume. Mount Bagana's last major eruption was in 2023, which forced the evacuation of nearby villages. Torokina District Coordinator Bonifasi Wadari says the local mobile phone network is patchy and he's concerned about its reliability if there's another big blow up.
In 2023, we have major eruption that caused some people to be displaced, and we call them IDPs, internal displaced people. So we moved them to safer grounds, or especially we moved them to Torokina District. administration center. So in 2023, there's a lot of assistance from development partners and NGOs to respond to the activity that caused by Mount Bangano.
When did you notice it was erupting?
So the recent eruption is happened. It's happened in midnight, the 19th. So it erupted and it's some magma was discharged for about 15 minutes. And then it's the peak of the mountain was grow for about 30 minutes and then it goes off. And it discharges some ashes, but because the wind was blowing north, so the communities that was affected, mainly in the Rotokasu area, like Ruluwu and all this. And between Torokina district, Achinima, and the coastal on the mountain, it's but not that bad as it was happening in 2023. So there's some basic monitoring and assessment was conducted in the district. RBO was doing all the monitoring through the seismograph. And so there was no much destruction was caused in Torokina district.
What is the status now?
The status of that, now the alert one was issued by the RBO. And there was a close monitoring of the situation on the ground. But some people in the area, basically within the vicinity where the, we would say the danger zone near Mount Bangano, the people was just, now they reset all back. There was not like movement or displays and all this. So mainly the water sources was a bit of affected. So the people are now back in their communities. But there's some awareness that need to be done in the communities about the pollution that is caused, mainly with water sources pollution. So now the volcano is steady, like it's not really discharging ashes and all this.
I understand in 2025 a monitoring system was installed there. How effective has it been?
Well, the three major things that mainly was raised in the earliest eruption and still was, one is the communication should be in really should be a good communication system in place, like the coverage, the phone, like now we should have a good tower that's cover at least a lot of communities when the early warning is given, we should communicate with all the communities about that alert or like the volcano is about to erupt. So there is not improvement to communication in the district. So at least we should have a good communication in place, like the tower that is working, like not like currently. It will go for some days, some weeks. Then we restore the service again and all this. So when that tower is off, then the real time data is not provided to RVO. So that's one thing we really need to, like the government or development partners can really assist to improve the communication system in the district. The other thing is the access escape route. Escape route should be one of the development focus. So when we have the eruption warnings, we should move the people to safer ground with a good escape route. Currently, we don't have those. There's no road to the communities that we can move the community.
And that's Torokina District Coordinator Borafashi Wadari speaking to PNG reporter Belinda Cora. And meanwhile, Bougainville's government wants full independence from Papua New Guinea by 2030. The territory's president, Ismail Torama, submitted his government's position to an independent facilitator overseeing the joint technical consultations with PNG. It proposes full self-governance for Bougainville from the 1st of September 2027 before attaining independence by 2030. President Ismail Torama spoke to the media following this presentation and says Port Moresby must negotiate with the full intention of facilitating independence.
The majority has voted. You know, the leadership have taken that stand to make sure that
whatever comes out of their shared responsibility and with the leaders' responsibility. The leaders' responsibility on the table is to absolutely protect the 97.7. The people of Bougainville has voted us, and for us to pursue independence as through the Bougainville Peace Agreement. The peace agreement reminds us that it will be based only on the outcome of the vote of the people, which is independence.
And Bougainville has been tracking towards independence since a referendum in 2019 saw 97.7% of voters vote yes for full independence. However, Port Moresby has demanded a stringent review, with this month PNG's Parliament passing a sessional order requiring 75% of its MPs to approve any recognition of Bougainville independence. Earlier this week, Prime Minister James Marape pledged support for Bougainville independence, but proposed a further 15-year transition process to review the performance of Bougainville's self-governance. But President Torama says his side won't accept anything less than independence.
So the consultation on the table is on independence, nothing else. It's no higher autonomy, nothing else. So that's why we have come again and said, yes, I think, the parliament has, national parliament has its own view, but the mandate of the people has mandated the leadership of Bougainville to consult over independence and nothing more else. I think that is where we are coming from.
And that was Bougainville President Ishmael Toroama. Alrighty, for the past three decades, more than 570 children from countries including Vanuatu, Fiji, Tonga, Samoa and Papua New Guinea have received life-changing medical treatment through the Rotary Oceania Medical Aid for Children. Only earlier this year, ROMAC helped a 23-month-old girl named Januli travel from Santo Island in Vanuatu to Sydney for life-saving heart surgery, a service simply not available in her home country. It's the story of hope, and outgoing ROMAC Chair Glenys Parton joins us now to share about the work that they do. With that, I say good morning, Glenys, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Morena, Aggie. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. Appreciate your time. Well, look, firstly, Januli's story I know is not the first of its kind, right, but definitely highlights the need for ROMAC. I mean, how did Januli end up on your list of candidates?
Well, we have a broad referral process. So Januli came to us, referred by a visiting pediatric cardiac specialist who visits Vanuatu quite frequently and has clinics, and she came through that referral process. But referrals come from the local doctors, from visiting Rotarians, and from even visiting visitors, on the island.
I think that's the great thing, though, is obviously these referrals, because the truth is that some of these treatments can cost more than like $100,000, right?
Yes, the costs are rising for these, obviously, with rising costs globally. Cost of living rises, so naturally costs have gone up. Usually we got these treatments done around $40,000, but now they're creeping up to the $100,000 mark for sure. So we're on a campaign to make sure we can continue this work.
Beautiful. And of course, with Januli, her story is about having that life-saving heart surgery. Can I just ask, Glenys, what was her condition like pre-surgery, though?
She came to us, which is not often, she came to us with a medical escort, so she was quite unwell. She had a hole in her heart and came into Sydney with a medical escort. However, once she got there, straight into Sydney Children's and Ronald McDonald House, assessed, and clearly each child is assessed and programmed for surgery by the heart specialist in each facility, in this case the heart specialist.
Wow.
for this child.
And as soon as they get into surgery, what does that look like for ROMAC? What are you doing in terms of, because I understand you have volunteers, so what's the work that you are doing behind the scenes?
We have an amazing regional team. This particular one in Sydney is incredible. So they make sure that the mother is well cared for and supported. You can imagine coming from Vanuatu, never faced, you know, Sydney traffic and Sydney processes, never been in a car seat. All of these things we have to consider. And then the day-to-day, sitting with the guardian or the parent, alongside the surgery, explaining what's happening. And they also, the regional team, facilitate local care through their migrant groups to facilitate translation if necessary. So really a wraparound service for that family. And that's the thing that we pride ourselves on, is providing that wraparound experience, hosting the child and the guardian in their homes if necessary for the first couple of days, and then into Ronald McDonald, providing food and Ronald McDonald, ensuring that they know how things like washing clothes, etc., can be done. And even when they get off the plane, making sure that they have warm clothes that are more suitable for our climate. All those things are part of our checklist when we take our family into our care.
Sounds like some top-tier type of care there, Glenys, which is great to hear. I do want to know, how did Janulli's surgery go? I mean, how is she doing now?
She returned. She was 5 weeks with us. That's quite, you know, a reasonably short period of time. But what we find with these children is the surgery is life-changing. So they come to us quite ill and sick and quite a shut down personality. And it's almost like they have a personality transplant as well as the surgery on their heart, because they just spring back to life and they've got a smile on their face. They've got that energy back, you know, with a poor heart, they lack the energy, and it's so delightful. Mm. It's just unbelievable to see this little wee bundle that's quite, you know, sick, then running round. So she returned home 5 weeks after her surgery and welcomed back into Santo, you know, really good to go.
No, and I did read up on her story, and I think sometimes stories like this really does highlight a level of inequality, right, within healthcare across the region. I'm just wondering, in some cases, Glenys, not all kids would be able to get this type of help in their own country, right? Like, so what happens then?
Well, Aggie, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Romac can treat, you know, a group of them, but the need is really great. And getting to them, getting the right information on them, getting them referred into our system is really important. But actually, you know, there's a bigger picture here. How do we care for these island nations and in our front yard, in the front yard of Australia and New Zealand, by improving their health outcomes and making it more equitable? It's very difficult, particularly when they come from, you know, distant parts on islands that are fragmented in the health system that they have in their country. So just one child at a time, we have to step through to make a difference. And if we can make that difference, it helps their family, it helps their village, it helps their island, and it helps their country. That's our kind of mantra.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's a mantra I think a lot of people would be interested and invested in too. We'll put some details up alongside, you know, your story this morning. But that's all the time we've got for this morning, Glenys. I do want to just say thank you very much for the work you guys do and appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
And that is outgoing Rotary Oceania Medical Aid for Children Chair Glenys Parton.
Every game.
What a brilliant try!
Every week.
Beautiful.
Don't miss a minute of the NRL in 2026.
It's game on, baby! This is remarkable footy.
With Andrew Moore and the best team in the business.
What a performance. What a game. What a team.
Hear it all right here.
Unbelievable.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Game, set, bingo.
Your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Well, speaking of sport, the battle to save Moana Pasifika from extinction has been lost, with New Zealand Rugby opting not to transfer the club's licence because they say none of the bidders were able to meet the necessary business requirements. However, as Richard Hewitt reports, it may not be all over yet, because there is hope that Moana could resurface for the 2028 Super Rugby Pacific season. And if not, then a new Pasifika entity could take their place.
It's a sad end for a side created to fly the flag for players from Tonga and Samoa, but which managed to survive for just five seasons in Super Rugby Pacific. Outbid for the licence 6 years ago, Tracy Atinga and her Kanaloa consortium were more than willing to step in and take Moana over, but they couldn't persuade New Zealand Rugby to give them that chance.
For us, I think it was really important that we tried to do everything we could to salvage Moana Pasifika as is for the players and the staff. That was our first and foremost commitment, was to try and help that to happen. But unfortunately, with the timing, and this is something that New Zealand Rugby will support, with the timing and everything happening the way it did and everything going into liquidation, that process became far too difficult for everybody. We were trying our best to salvage what was there so that we could look after the players and the staff. But that's now going to be something that the New Zealand government and everybody involved in that liquidation process will have to manage.
And Kanaloa's CEO is critical of Moana's owners PMA for pulling the plug and calling in the liquidators before any takeover talks had reached a conclusion.
You know, I want to say that that effectively did kill any opportunity for any party to come in. We actually made an offer to the liquidator very early on to buy out all of the assets. And unfortunately, they let us know that PMA had not relinquished the IP assets to the liquidation process. And on that note, there wasn't anything of great or significant value. So we will remain there with the liquidator and talk to them as they continue down their path. But yeah, I would say that that didn't help New Zealand Rugby's cause to try and get this over the line.
At the Tonga Rugby Union, Chief Executive Aisea Aholele is as disappointed as anyone because Moana's closure shuts down a pathway for Tongan players. But he stops short of suggesting that New Zealand Rugby could have tried harder to keep the club alive.
Yes, we can say that this is for the benefit of Tonga and Samoa, but looking at it in the bigger picture, obviously the financial element of running an organisation like Moana Pasifika and what are the liabilities for New Zealand Rugby. And I don't think there's any sinister way to what they're doing or if they're not trying their best, but try to think why they do this. And it's always the commercial side of things.
And without Moana providing a home for Tonga and international players, the likelihood is the union's costs will rise every time they bring their squad together.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Just to assemble them in one place, like New Zealand, to bring them from Europe or Japan or the US, that's a cost that New Zealand or Australia don't really have to look at. All their players are in front of them. But for us and Samoa as well, we have to try and negate those costs somehow. But really helps if Moana was there.
So the good news is that while Moana's immediate fate has been sealed, relations between Kanaloa and New Zealand Rugby appear to be much more cordial now than they were when the whole saga began. And Tracy Atinga is confident that the Pasifika flag can be raised in Super Rugby again in 2 years' time. And she says her stakeholders remain fully committed and invested.
Yep. New Zealand Rugby are willing to now sit at the table with all of our stakeholders. You know, if you think about that, that's Lakapi Samoa, Tonga Rugby, Niue, Cook Islands Rugby, and all of the other Pacific Island nations to actually develop this piece moving forward. That's the exciting bit. Because if we can start having those discussions where we are having a voice at the table to explain what's important to us, what drives Pasifika, and how best to serve our communities in the process, that's the part that we're winning. And, you know, we're excited about that.
And for the Tongan Rugby Union, Aisea Aholele says there is a chance now for them to have a say on what the model for a future Pasifika Super Rugby team should look like.
From the beginning for us here in Tonga, you know, we weren't really engaged in the setup of Moana Pasifika. It just came to us. We supported it, and there's no question to that, and we'd fully support Moana Pasifika, but it has to be a ground-up look at it for the reset. How involved are the two unions in the setup, and obviously the commercial side, and also the player pathways as well. And that's probably the most important part for us, is the players and how we can try and manage them.
It's a really sad day for Moana Pasifika, but it's also a really important day moving forward, because now we have a voice at the table to shape what 2028 and beyond looks like. I mean, it is Super Rugby Pacific.
And that's Tracy Atinga, the CEO of the Kanaloa Consortium. Reported there was Richard Hewitt. and new resources helping to reshape conversations around sexual health and well-being for Pacific youth. Pleasurenesia was created to provide information through a culturally relevant lens to encourage young people to speak up about consent, healthy relationships, pleasure and sexual well-being. A guide like this may just help bring change through meaningful dalanoa or conversations. So joining us this morning to delve more into this is Architect of Cooperation Pacific, SRHR, Humanitarian Hub, Wate Tamanikaikira Roi. Yandra Wate.
Yandra Egi, thanks for having me.
Oh, appreciate you coming on the show. Look, here enters Pleasurenesia. I just need to know what this really is about. I know I've shared a little bit, but if you could give us a better outline of what this resource is.
Sure. So Pleasurenesia was a guide that was made by the young people, and particularly the Youth Oceans, which was a regional youth network for IPPF. And basically, the guide came out of discussions that we were having with young people that the sex ed resources that felt foreign, clinical, and it felt like someone just wrote it in another country and dropped it here. It didn't sound like us and didn't use our examples, and it didn't sort of reflect how we actually grew up talking or not talking about sexual reproductive health. So the Pleasurenesia was playing on Polynesian and Micronesian names that were never ours to begin with, and outsiders drew on these lines. And we sort of used that to reclaim our priority in our conversation, particularly on sexual reproductive health, to be ours. And it was small on the surface, but it sets the tone for the whole guide.
Well, so then what they can I ask, you know, you talk about pleasure and it being shaped right by Pacific people for Pacific people. What then now is the narrative through an actual Pacific one? What does that look like?
So specifically, it looks like it talks about sex ed only not to avoid pregnancy or avoid HIV or avoid STIs, but the important bit was how someone feels, whether you feel respected, whether you feel pressured, or whether we actually got the data on this from now on how sexual reproductive health were communicated. Particularly when this research was also informed, this Pleasurenesia was also informed by a research that we did. And we noticed that the difference between the upbringing for boys were often told straight up that it meant, in their own words, that if condoms feel the way it doesn't feel better without it. One boy said it wasn't comfortable using because it was plastic, not a small thing. So when we were talking about pleasure when it comes to the feeling of the condom, we also noticed that this was often not used in sex ed resources in the Pacific that was currently available. It often left out this conversation. So what we tried to do, it was not telling anyone or to do or pushing any behavior. It was giving a way for young people to talk about consent and relationship that actually fits how we talk out our know and storytelling instead of a clinical approach. There was sort of no way to run it. So we built it in a Talanoa outline, a structured version for schools, even had a playbook for practical activities, things like a card game, group storytelling exercises, simple visual tool for mapping feelings. So people that would pick up their suits in their community instead of copying something word for word off a page. I think the flexibility around it is actually the most important design choice in the whole thing. So a facilitator in the youth group in Suva and a facilitator running a session somewhere in the church hall in Kiribati are working on completely different rooms, but the guy doesn't pretend that the rooms are the same. You know what I'm trying to say? Huh?
Wow. So this really is just sex education island style, isn't it? I mean, and I often understand that, you know, talking about that conversation can be taboo across the Pacific. Have there been sort of any pushback or challenges along the way?
Yep, there has been. The hard parts were shame and fear, basically. Like, particularly in our communities here in Fiji, we have terms on mandua or shame or fear. And it cuts both ways. So boys sort of get punished socially for being soft if they prioritize protection. Girls get labeled promiscuous if they were asking about sexual health. And both of these come from the same place. Like, nobody's allowed to be honest about what's actually going on. We even had a Methodist pastor in one of our rural interviews and talked about how we talk more openly. Children need guidance and church must help. So it's not like every faith leader is against this. Some are quietly ready for it. It was just about the dominant culture in a lot of institutions that were still conservative. So individual voices like that pastor don't always get the space to lead.
So then with Plesionesia, is it then really able to adapt to reflect, you know, Pacific cultures? Because even its values, why I say that is, how do you actually hold a safe space for our young people when dealing with their sexual health?
I think the Plesionesia, the framing was around finding a balance to act between culture and health. Eh? So we weren't telling young people or communities to put their values aside, because young people reckon the culture in our Pacific is respect, care, and responsibility, and that's already there in the Plesionesia guides. That's already strong also in our culture. But what the guide does is connect those existing values to conversations about consent and pleasure, and also in our own language rather than someone else's whole term. So the approach was holistic in a way that communities who talked to first, that allowed communities to talk first, how to ask permission, particularly for young people, and how young people can build trust slowly rather than walking and assuming welcome. Yeah.
What are the outcomes, though, that you are really hoping to see come out from the Plesionesia guide? Like, is this something that is not just for Fiji there, but could be used right across the Pacific?
Yes, definitely. It could be used right across the Pacific, because, again, how this was developed was consultations and focus group discussions with young people from our 10-member association. So the idea was to replicate it and adapt it across the Pacific with community facilitators and peer educators within the health system and also with the local government.
And that's the other part I want to touch on. Is this something that you're wanting to see be put through policy? Has government seen what you guys are doing? What's happening in that area?
So the Plesionesia guide was also launched with our youth strategy for the Pacific. That was the first one, was a youth strategy in sexual reproductive health. And this was launched in Melbourne during the Women Deliver conference. But prior to that, we had our member associations working alongside their government to also launch the Plesionesia guides and the separate youth national SRHL strategy in country. So they're, for Tuvalu, for example, their prime minister has made a stand also to protect the rights of young people in sexual reproductive health. And we had also the minister for social welfare in Kiribati, who also made a statement that they will be prioritizing and advancing support for young people. So our member associations were working in this country with their governments, and they were institutionalizing this along the way. And hopefully by the end of this year, we get to see the big blue ocean strategy that really prioritizes youth and in sexual reproductive health.
Beautiful. Wate, look, that's all the time that we have, but I just want to say vinaka for coming on the show and sharing about Plesionesia and the work that you are doing there in Fiji.
So, thanks again for having me.
No worries. That, of course, is Wate Tamanikaiaroi, Architect of Cooperation Pacific, SRHR Humanities Hub, here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Look, let's take a look at some of our main stories. Meteorological agencies around the Pacific are warning that a major El Nino is occurring and could bring less rainfall, possible droughts, and the greater likelihood of cyclones.
Coming this tropical cyclone season in November to April next year for Tonga, our likelihood or the frequency of tropical cyclone will be elevated.
Find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into search engine. Remember, we're across our social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram, but you can catch us at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but also this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, because your news is next, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, o tō awhātum. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.